Oh, that's nice, huh? I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order Thursday, April 23rd. Thank you for taking the time, committee, to have a little evening to go over some of the amendments that are before us on two bills that we will be dealing with tonight, our House Bill 2366 and House Bill 2191. Everything else on this agenda will be carried over. So, again, if you're here on something else, those bills are being carried over until Friday, tomorrow at 3 p.m. So, again, we're just dealing with House Bill 2366 and 2191.
Ready to join us, though.
They're all running out on us.
So, with that, committee, I think we're going to start out with House Bill 2366. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2366. And Victoria, can you give us a brief summary of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2366 establishes the Residential Structure Lien Assistance Fund to be administered by the Construction Contractors Board, allows capped payouts from the fund to certain lien claimants if owner has paid construction contractor but contractor has not paid claimant, requires paid lien claimant to file satisfaction of lien or judgment, appropriates monies from the general fund for 2009 to 2011 biennium, and requires repayment no later than June 30th of 2011. Fund will be continually replenished through a surcharge not to exceed $40 on application for issuance or renewal of residential contractor endorsement, effective on passage with first payment from fund to occur during calendar year 2010.
And could you please mention the latest amendment that we're going to be talking about tonight?
We have -3 amendments, which should be in front of you, and we do have fiscal and revenue statements on the -3 amendments.
Thank you. And I have asked the Construction Contractors Board to help us through this amendment, explain it to the committee, because this is a deviation from the original concept of the Lien Assistance Fund. That was based on either penalties or licensing fees. I believe this amendment moves away from that concept and goes at this issue in a slightly different way. So, could I have Craig Smith, please?
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, and I'd like to thank the chair for his leadership again on this particular issue. Some of you know that this has been a perennial issue, and of course we have a new adjustment here to the solution. I should tell you that what's being handed to you now is a analysis that was done by Bill Boyd. Bill is a lawyer. You saw him last time on this matter. I have to admit to you today that I am not a lawyer. I am not a person who's an expert in lien law, but I can tell you from a high level what this bill does, what I believe the outcomes are, and what Bill has done for us in this analysis is broken down each section by section and told us what in the Construction Contractors Board, in his opinion, what each section does. And when he does that, actually, I can almost tell you with a straight face how the lien law works. The lien law is complicated, and if you want some legal analysis on this, I'm not your man. But if you want to know the policy behind it, I'm the guy that's been working with this probably as long as anybody has. So with that said, Chair and members of the committee, what the -3 amendments do is substitute a solution that's rather simple. It substitutes the solution for
excuse
the paint
me.
Twice.
Craig, just a minute. If you could just hold on a minute. I want to just make sure my two committee members are on the same page with us. We are looking at House Bill 2366, and it is the Dash 3 amendments. And as I just briefly explained, the bill originally dealt with dealing with this issue where consumers pay a general for a project on their home and end up the general doesn't pay the sub or the supplier, and that sub or supplier puts a lien on their house, and they essentially end up having to pay twice. That's we come up with the pay twice lien problem. And we've moved away from the assistance fund altogether in the Dash 3 amendments. And so we are looking at a different way of dealing with this problem, and Craig has just started talking to us about the Dash 3s. I apologize.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. So we're on this chart, and I'll just walk you through the amendments. On page one of the the cover page really is a good summary of what the bill does. And again, this is a gut and stuff. It produces a solution to the pay twice problem so that if a consumer pays once and then gets a lien filed on their property by a sub or supplier, a court may disallow that lien if the consumer can prove that they paid their primary contractor for the work that is the subject of the supplier's or subcontractor's lien. That's it in a nutshell. It's that simple. It's an elegant solution, and it's a solution that I can tell you that has been offered many times, and as I've said before, I appreciate the courage of this committee and the chair to offer it again for your consideration. So walking you through quickly on the amendments, because I know the sections, this is an analysis of those sections. The first part of this bill talks about the right to lien notice, and that's the notice that the subs and suppliers have to give out to the homeowner, because they come out and do the work. If I were to, or a primary contractor, you were to give the primary contractor a contract, I might hire a sub to do the work. And the sub then, if it wants to maintain its lien right, must give you, deliver this notice to you. It tells you about the possibility of a lien. So this is slightly altered in this bill in order to conform with the solution that is the subject of the bill, but it is not the guts of the bill. So that's section one. Section 2 on page 4 of this analysis talks about the part of the lien law that allows a consumer, if they do get a filing of a lien, the consumer can come to the Construction Contractors Board and ultimately get a stay in court that prevents the foreclosure of the lien, as I understand it, until a consumer goes through the Construction Contractors Board process in hopes to get access to the bond of the primary contractor. So in the case, the sub ultimately gets paid from funds that the consumer has already paid to the primary contractor. That money would come from the CCB and from the bond process, and so that's what that's all about. And this slightly changes that language, but most of this is modernization. It is not the guts of the bill. It does not have a significant or any policy impact that I'm aware of. So that's really not what we're here, I think, to talk about. And again, that analysis is on page 4. Then as we get into this document, and I apologize if the copying isn't printed. I guess it's printed all right. When we get to section 3, there you are. That's the guts of the bill. And in the second box there, which is sub 3, and if I can, I'll simply read it in the record. The important part is the dark part there at the bottom of the page where it reads, the court shall disallow the lien if the owner proves that the owner paid the contractor for the materials and equipment, labor, or services that are the basis for the lien. This subsection does not prohibit a court from state proceedings and so forth. So that simple sentence really is the solution that's offered by this bill. Again, you see the analysis on the right-hand side in that box. And what it states, among other things, is the rest of the changes in the bill from our perspective are modernization of the current language. It does not substantially change current law. It certainly doesn't change the policy. So, that's my testimony, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I appreciate you being able to come and walk us through this. When I first looked at this, I looked at that paragraph and I said, "Geez, it's just that simple," you know. And because we've been battling this for a couple of years, and in our last hearing committee and Mr. Smith, I think there were several. There was a couple of members that just were expressing the lament that this isn't the case right now, and as well as the contractors coming forward and say they would actually prefer this over creating an assistance fund based on licensing and fees or penalties or some other way to keep the consumer whole. And so I hope that we can solve this problem and get this piece of legislation through the building. Time will tell on that, of course, but certainly I want to open this up for discussion and questions while we have Mr. Smith here for the committee. So, Representative Cowan.
Thank you. This makes me very happy. It just didn't make sense to me the way it was before, and I think this makes a great deal of sense. I guess the only question I have is the subcontractors then. So if I heard you correctly, their right to get paid is against the contractor's bond?
Mm. Chair Hovey and Representative Cohen, that's not what I attempted to say.
Well, I could have been misunderstood. Yeah. What happens to the subs?
What happens to the subs is they're the ones that then bear the risk of non-payment. And in the small number of cases that we hope that are really the subject of this terrible problem, they ultimately could be left out in the cold. Okay. And, of course, that's not a comfortable place for them to be. But, they may be in a better position to accept that risk than the homeowner is. So,
thank you.
Representative Winger. Go ahead.
No, I'm fine. Go ahead.
Representative Winger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Craig, I heard you say elegant but simple. I agree this is elegant. I'm not sure it may be simple. I'm waiting for some reaction. Because, first of all, I'm delighted that we decided to go on a more... It's just nice to see a bill that simplifies Oregon law rather than where we were headed, which was to make it even more complicated. But I just want to be... I guess it's my natural cynicism to worry that something this simple can't just be that simple, and that there must be a reason. There must have been resistance somewhere along the line that we haven't heard yet. So I guess I'm wondering: have you had a chance to talk to folks within the industry and get some feedback on them? The chair made the suggestion that they had indicated that they would prefer this solution. Is you've been doing this for a while? Is what's their reaction likely to be?
Right. Well, Chair Hovey and Representative Wingert, I can tell you that I have not talked with the people whose ox will be gored, okay? And in the years that I've been doing this, and, I sit here before you thinking back when I was very young, sitting at this table with this solution in front of this assembly, a young 24-year-old who had just been appointed to the Builders Board, thinking, well, this is how we ought to fix this problem, and looking behind me where we had homeowners who came in and testified about the pain of this problem, And I can tell you that back in 1983 or so, when we offered this solution, it didn't prevail. And it didn't prevail then because of the reason that nagging thing that is at the back of your mind, which is, surely there's some opposition to this. And I think you can imagine who it is. It's the people who has a higher risk. Now, with that said, I think that it makes good public policy. I am not in your chair.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I agree. I think it is better public policy, but ultimately somebody does bear the risk. So let's set aside the argument of just, obviously you'd get resistance from folks who say they don't want the risk shifted onto them. Let's just accept that as their legitimate argument. But since you have been in this arena for a long time, I would just like your expertise on how you think this might change the industry, affect the industry as far as whether or not people in my case, when I did some remodeling recently, I got a refinance and I pulled money out, so I had the cash. I could prepay everyone, but I'm no expert on this. So how is this likely to change practice out in the industry? And given that we're in a housing slump and basic activity like this is down, should we be concerned, and this is just an open-ended question, should we be concerned that the change in policy we're making might make it more difficult for projects to move forward simply because they don't have the money up front?
Right. And Chair Holvey and members of the committee, the answer to the question is you should be concerned. It's possible, and there will be people, if you don't hear it today, others will hear it another day, that there will be significant problems if this solution, and I think there will be folks who say that who have as much experience as I, and some who believe it in their heart. I can tell you that my opinion is that it would be best for the economy. And I can tell you that from my opinion, where I sit, people will choose to deal with primary contractors for whom they trust, and they won't extend credit inappropriately. It's the inappropriate extension of credit that has got us to where we are today, and this could be one step forward that brings us back to sanity in my book. I'm sorry if I'm getting on to the soapbox, but I think it's a good idea. Now, will there be a change in dynamics? Yes. Will some people argue that that change will be bad? Yes. Will it be bad? In my opinion, no. It will be for the better.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Roiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just actually covered a lot of what my question was going to be. I guess the way I see this, and I want your feedback, and I think I actually just got it, is that subs are going to not take jobs now where they know they're not going to get paid. As the law stands today, it doesn't matter to them. I mean, it does a little bit, but not in the degree that it will, whether the primary is a good risk or not. Now, they don't care because they have something to fall back on. Now, those general contractors, those primary contractors who are the problem, will not have any subs working for them.
And I think that's Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, that sounded more like a statement than a question, and I think it would be a statement that I would tend to agree with. Some will still risk it. Some will lose when they do that risk. But again, I think this is all about who should bear the risk, the homeowner who pays or the sub who is in a pretty good position to know who's going to go belly up next month and who might not. The bigger problem, and I'm sure it's one you thought of but maybe didn't discuss there in your analysis, was what about the supplier? It's the suppliers who are really extending credit out there, and in some cases they may choose not to supply materials to people they don't trust. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think it's not bad.
Other questions? Well, Craig, let me finish up with just one, just to reiterate. You know, in the tables that you'd submitted to us before, I think you had stated there was 27 claims dealing with this lien twice right. per year, or just in this last year. And although there are other claims that probably are made that include this problem, so it's probably a bit higher than that potentially. But so if you were to turn this thing around, you know, you would have that equal amount of problems that subs would be having with their generals who don't pay them after the consumers paid them. I wouldn't think that it would be a bigger problem than what already exists. It's just that it's going to be a problem for the subs and the suppliers, and not for the homeowner who's already paid for the product or service.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I think your memory is correct. Those are the amount of claims that the board received, and you may recall my testimony that we probably don't receive all of the complaints. There probably are a number that we don't see because people don't file the paperwork, but I would venture to say it's not a large number.
And thank you. I just want to make another perhaps statement, and maybe not so much of a question, but maybe you can comment on it, is that the subs and suppliers that work in this industry are better able to I guess be more familiar with the participants in that industry, the people they do business with, and from my short time in the construction industry, reputations of contractors were pretty well known inside the industry, of who does good work, who does this, who does that, who pays their bills on time, who doesn't, and what kind of financial shape they're actually in. It's been my experience that the industry knows that amongst themselves, even the suppliers, much better than the consumer would have information on that. And because it always sort of occurs to me that I've experienced suppliers who would send supplies to a general contractor who's already in a position of filing for bankruptcy, and they would continue to supply that general contractor because they had nothing to lose, really. And then a homeowner oftentimes in a situation like that gets burnt. So I think this particular approach to the bill, to this problem, really goes a long ways in making suppliers and subs be more responsible with who they do business with. I don't know if you care to comment on my perception of that or not.
Well, Chair Holvey, it's my opinion, and whether I share your opinion. And, you know, we could be wrong. I've heard people argue very strongly the other direction that I can, and again, I don't want to steer you the wrong way here, but when people talk to me about this, they've said, well, homes won't be built, and it'll cause more complaints for homeowners, and there's a lot of arguments get thrown at me. But again, I think that's kind of what makes a horse race. There usually are two sides. It's just my opinion that this is the better side.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments, committee? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
No, did we have anybody else signed up on this?
That's amazing.
I don't think so. Is the committee willing to adopt an amendment?
Let's do it.
Okay, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2366 and open a work session on House Bill 2366.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the adoption of the -3 amendment to House Bill 2366.
Briley moves the Dash 3 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2366. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? Seeing none, the Dash 3 amendments are adopted to House Bill 2366. Committee, I don't know if you're comfortable moving this bill at this point. Do we have the fiscal and...
Yep.
Mr. Chair.
And before you make a motion, there is a subsequent to Ways and Means that has been rescinded. So because the fiscal came back, I don't know if we had time to distribute that to the committee yet. The fiscal came back.
We don't have the fiscal.
Minimal.
That was right in front.
So the motion would have to include that. Here, I'll make it easier.
Make it easy.
Because I don't know if I could remember how to do that. Start down here.
Yeah. Right here.
Yep.
You ready?
Representative Briley.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2366 is amended to the floor of the do-pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Briley moves House Bill 2366 as amended to the floor with the do-pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly to say that when something that's been this confounding comes up with an elegant and simple solution, it makes me want to be happy, but it also makes me suspicious. But I think that if we don't have significant testimony to the contrary, and we've had time, this is kind of our busy season, and we've had time to post and people have had an opportunity, I think that I'm going to go with simple and elegant and hope that we have found a solution that will improve this. The last thing I would say is I'm concerned at times that we need a little bit of consumer responsibility with our consumer protection, and I was concerned that, you know, we might be letting folks off too easily, but I don't think that's the case here, so I'll be voting aye.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Representative Wingard.
It's my impression, Mr. Chair, that no one may have seen these amendments till today, so it's entirely possible that reaction is still to come. But irregardless of that, I still think this is a quality bill, and this is the public policy direction that this should have gone in. And frankly, I'm a little bit sorry to hear that it's taken 25 years or more to get us there. But there are, as a person who believes in the market very strongly, there are certain market mechanisms that work. And as has been articulated out here already, allowing subs to have that relationship with the general contractor is not something we expect consumers to be able to spend a lot of time on. And why we would make an exception in this when we don't really in anywhere else where there are sub... or, you know, business-to-business relationships, essentially, out there that the consumer may never be aware of or fully understand. That's part of the elegance of the market system, and I think a lot of that patrolling and decision and good decision-making occurs when you set people free to both gain and suffer the consequences of bad decisions around things like credit and others. I'll shut up, but I think this, I'm just happy because this is probably the most exciting bill for me out of consumer protection. So
it's your solution.
And I'm just pleased to see this moving and very happy to support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I will say, you know, it was the conversations amongst the committee members that led me to take this left-hand turn on this issue. And
or
as,
right
as
hand.
Not left.
Or
not
right
left.
Hand.
Okay, right-hand turn.
Let's not derail it at this point,
yeah.
Okay?
I'm off this bill.
Yeah. So, but it was also, you know, the home builders and the remodelers also, you know, took... You know, I'm sure they have some reservations about this, but they saw this as a better solution too, is what they indicated to me. Now, I believe there will be some grumblings about this, and there are people in the industry and the suppliers as well are, you know, really probably not going to be real happy about this, because they're going to have to change their business model a little bit with, or maybe not their business model, but they're going to have to be a little more careful of who they extend credit to. And I think that's the difference in this. And but I think the point that the consumers get stuck in this scenario is really an egregious situation that's gone on too long. So I appreciate all your comments, and I appreciate the thought that's gone into this, and I appreciate the CCB for helping us get there. So with that, Amber, roll call vote, please, Cindy.
Representative Barton?
Excused.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Excused.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wingard?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
The chair votes aye as well. The House Bill 2366, having received the required votes, is declared passed to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. And the subsequent referral to Ways and Means having been rescinded. So with that, who hasn't carried a bill for a while?
Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to carry the bill.
I think I'm going to try to get Representative Krieger to handle it, if he would. I think he's due.
Okay. I'll have the lobby do my floor speech or staff. See. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. With that, I'm going to close the... I already closed the work session. No, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2366. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2191. Victoria, can you give us a review of House Bill 2191?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2191 requires persons who provide debt management service to register with the Department of Consumer and Business Services unless exempt, authorizes DCBS to require registrants to maintain corporate surety bond or a revocable letter of credit, allows grievant to take action against registrant's bond or letter of credit, specifies contents of contracts for debt management services, and requires registrants to provide reports on funds held in trust account effective on passage. And you should have dash one amendments in front of you.
Which dash one?
Yes, there was also a dash two, I think, that was submitted by, I don't know who had those drafted. I know they came from Mr. Oxley. So, but with that, I think... the committee worked on the dash one amendments, and I believe the dash two came from Mr. Oxley and his clients. And I'm going to start out the hearing by going to David Tapman from the Department of Consumer and Business Services to walk through the dash one amendments, if he would. Or maybe trot through them. Having heard this bill before committee, it's been a little while since we heard it. February 9th, we did have a series of meetings with industry, with consumer groups, and with department on this issue, and it was. Somewhat complicated, but I think we've come up with a proposal in the dash one amendments that the chair is comfortable with, and I have had a short conversation about the dash twos, but we'll have a chance to talk about those a little bit more. Welcome, Mr. Tapman. Thank you for appearing this evening. If you would state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair,
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify this evening. My name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is one of the regulatory agencies within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. You have before you written testimony that I've submitted to address the Dash 1s. We've had an opportunity to review the Dash 1s that came out yesterday, and we've also looked at the Dash 2s, and although others that are proponents of the Dash 2, or at least attempt to be proponents, we've looked at both, and both of them are essentially identical with one minor change, and we're fairly comfortable with both. Having said that, though, I will walk through the Dash 1s and let others address the Dash 2s. Just by way of refreshing everyone's recollection, we're here today to discuss debt management practices. In the state of Oregon, we've had certain regulatory oversight of agencies called debt consolidation agencies and credit service organization agencies. And I will probably slip into jargon occasionally and say DCAs for debt consolidation and CSOs for credit service organizations. But we've also seen a proliferation of new entities that have come up called debt eliminators or debt service companies. And what the purpose of this bill is to regulate all aspects of debt management. As well too familiar at this point, we are going through an economic recession, and we are going through high levels, if not record high levels, of unemployment in Oregon. And those things are having a very disastrous effect on our consumers. And many of our consumers find themselves in a position where they're unable to address their financial obligations. They're well behind on a number of things. And I've talked to this committee several times about the recent spate of foreclosures and loan modifications and loan refinances. And this is yet another portion of what society is facing, and we're trying to address changes as we get into the Internet age. The purpose behind this Dash 1 is to make some significant changes to the original Bill 2191. So what we've got is essentially conceptually an effort to regulate, but we've modified that significantly. So without going through every section, I do want to address some of the highlights of that. The first thing we want to do is come up with a definition of what a debt management person is. And as I said, we will use our traditional debt consolidation and credit service organizations, but we also want to pick up these debt settlement companies. The debt settlement companies, just to refresh your recollection, are those companies who advertise in a fairly prolific manner that they can cut the amount of debt or obligation a person will have to pay with their creditors. And we've seen high-level, aggressive advertising in that area that may run as high as 30, 40, 50, 60% of your debt can be eliminated. And in return for a fee, and in conversation with members of the industry, that fee is typically 15% of all the debt obligations that are outstanding at the time the person comes for assistance. In return for that fee being paid up front over the course of usually the first 18 months of a typical three-year period of time, the company that's a debt settlement company will negotiate with creditors to reduce down the amount that the consumers owe. What the system is designed to do is to allow the consumers to build up a war chest, if you will, or a treasure chest, to be able to pay down a certain percentage. And when they get to a certain dollar amount, the debt settlement companies will come forward and negotiate with creditors saying, look, this may be the best this person can do, and the alternative could be bankruptcy. And if you go through bankruptcy, you may not even get this much. So we think this is a win-win for everyone. The challenges behind that are that, according to the industry again, maybe 55% of the people that go through this are successful and ultimately graduate, as they like to use the phrase, succeed in getting their debts reduced. So that leaves 45% that don't. In the meantime, people are paying a significant amount of money up front, as I said, 15% of their debt, and that is getting paid at the same time they're trying to amass this war chest. This is a very heavy financial burden. And so what we want to do is try and address that issue, bring these people, these debt settlement companies, in under regulation. As you know, there's another bill outstanding right now that would eliminate debt settlement companies. We think it's maybe the better practice to bring them in, license them, provide regulatory oversight with them, and make sure that they comply with certain limitations, including on the types of fees that they can charge. And so that's the goal behind this bill. And we've worked with members of a broad spectrum of Oregon society and companies. We've worked with consumer finance companies. We've worked with credit counseling companies. You heard about them. They're the nonprofits, and I believe you'll hear from Jan Amling, who represents them tonight. We've worked with lawyers who were engaged in bankruptcy, practice of bankruptcy law. We've worked with our debt settlement companies themselves, and we think we've arrived at a pretty good resolution. The only place where there's probably a challenge left is on the area of fees. And so with that, I'd just like to walk us through some of the high level, at a high level, what the Dash 1 amendments address. One of the things we were asked to address was the question about loan modification. And we think the definition picks up loan modifiers. As we've heard, there are a lot of people doing loan modifications for residential mortgage. But there's also a lot of people that want loan modifications for other consumer-type loans. And we want to make sure that the people that are doing that are reputable and are not just taking money up front and then disappearing. And so loan modifiers would be picked up under this definition. However, we create a carve-out from having to get licensed as a debt management company if you are a bank, a credit union, a consumer finance company, or a licensed mortgage lender. And so all the people that are already overseen and regulated that are engaged in consumer lending and consumer refinancing, we think should be outside the purview of this bill. But those that aren't need to be within that. So we try and pick up those providing loan modifiers. Another issue that was brought up during the various discussions were those that were brokers. I think we heard testimony in February about people who signed up with companies that were representing themselves to be Oregon companies, and it turned out they were doing business with a company that was not known to them in Florida or in Arizona or in other locales outside the state of Oregon. And it turned out that they were doing business with somebody that was brokering, in a sense, serving as a lead generator to identify Oregon citizens and then forwarding them on to these out-of-state companies. We want the lead generators, if you will, the brokers, to also be licensed to make sure that if they're engaged in this activity, they too are held to the same standards. So our definition would pick up the brokers or the lead generators. The bill obviously starts with the premise of registration, and the registration process is not that unlike all the others you've heard about that our agency does, and would allow for a number of people, whether they're providing consumer budgeting education, both profit and nonprofit, whether they're providing that debt consolidation activity in which they will collect money and hold it on behalf of consumers and then pay whatever they receive onto the creditors in return for a negotiated reduction in the interest rate or maybe a waiver of interest altogether. And they would pick up the debt settlement companies that I've just spent some time talking about. We want to get information about the individuals who are involved in this, make sure they don't have any type of negative history. Obviously, people who have been subject of lawsuits and judgments should have to disclose that before they get a license from us. We're also going to make sure, or we want to make sure under this bill, that we obtain some kind of bonding to ensure performance or a recourse if there is a failure to provide performance. As I said, we've received a number of complaints. I've got a list here, and it exceeds well over 50 in the past 12 to 18 months. I believe the chair has an article from the New York Times that discusses the number of people who have felt that have walked away from using these services because they felt like they weren't getting what they thought they could, they thought they were promised. And we've seen a number of complaints, according to that article, in Oregon alone, I think it was quadruple in the last 3 years. So Oregon, just like the rest of the country, is seeing pressure there. So we think the use of a surety bond is well advised. Most of our other licensees in the department have the requirement for surety bonds. Our DCAs, our debt consolidation agencies, are already required to have a surety bond or fidelity bond, depending on whether you're for-profit or not-for-profit. And we think that's appropriate for all people who get licensed with us. We would set the bond amount to be dependent on the amount of money a company handles. And in the case of a debt settlement company, we would set a minimum bond amount because they don't handle money. But we think it's important that agreed that consumers have some recourse against a surety bond if they don't get the contract that they enter to is not fulfilled. Stepping into that issue of written contracts, we think it's important. In fact, we use this requirement already with our debt consolidation agencies to have a written contract, just as simple as that. It's in writing and in easy to understand terms. We want to set a floor that minimum terms and requirements are in that contract. Obviously, those companies can go above and beyond that in terms of making sure consumers understand what they're getting into. But a minimum, we want the parties to understand who will be parties to this contract. Who is it that the debt management company will be working with? Which creditors will they work with? Which creditors won't they work with? On whose behalf are they collecting the money if they're collecting money? We want a clear statement in the contract of what the consumer, the debtor, is obligated to pay every month and how it's supposed to be paid and how that money can be accessed, whether the money goes straight into a trust fund held by the debt consolidation type debt management company or whether it goes into a bank account that is opened in the name or by the consumer and is not accessible. Either way, we want to be sure that the debtor understands what he or she is getting into. We also want to be very clear about what the fees are. As we'll see in a few minutes, there are a number of fees that can be charged, and so it's important that they understand those fees. And finally, we want to be abundantly clear that the consumer is to receive periodic financial reports about the status of where this process is going and what has been done on their behalf. Because as you may recall, in many instances, the consumer, the debtor, is advised to stop making payments to their creditors and put that money into that war chest or into that treasure chest to build up so that they can then negotiate from a certain amount. We want the contract to be and the disclosures to be crystal clear that if you're doing that, there are potential consequences, not the least of which is that the creditor may come after the debtor and pursue obtaining a judgment and then reducing judgment to collection. So those are the types of things that need to be clear, and also we think it's important that the company that's providing these services should be clear to the debtor what they are going to be telling the creditors on behalf of the debtor before they start the negotiation process. In addition, and this is something that I think we think this is an important piece that came out of discussions held with the various different entities and people, that there should be some type of written analysis of the basis for the company's decision to provide debt management services to each individual consumer. We think there has to be some analysis and not just take everybody that walks in the door. We heard a number of people testify that there are some consumers that are too far gone into debt that they can't help them. And if they're going to help them, it should be in good faith and not just an attempt to take some money. We've heard too often about companies that allegedly were going to provide services when the debtor's situation just was beyond salvaging and maybe bankruptcy was the right course of action. And we would expect these companies to, not as a fiduciary, but certainly as somebody who's trying to be reasonable and fair and act in good faith, to make an assessment that one could look at and determine made a determination that somebody could benefit from these services. Lastly, we want to be clear that, and we see this unfortunately not too often, contracts of adhesion, you may have heard it, where people will have the individual signing the contract waive certain provisions that are in there for protection. And the statutes that we're proposing in the Dash Ones would maintain that certain minimum protections cannot be waived by the debtor or consumer. In addition, we've also incorporated the right of rescission within the first 3 days. If somebody, for whatever reason, decides this isn't the way they want to go, they should have the right of rescission and a full refund of whatever fees that they've paid up to that point. And they should be able to cancel a contract, as well as all parties to a contract should be able to cancel. And we're suggesting that you have to give a 10-day notice. Now, that may not result in any refund because the fees that have, and the monies that have been paid may have already been passed on to either earned for services rendered or passed on to creditors. I mentioned that we want to use trust accounts to ensure that the individual funds that are held on behalf of consumers, and not all these different models under the debt management bill will hold their funds. We heard about the debt eliminators, the debt service the settlement companies. They typically don't hold the funds, so there would be no need for a trust account. But if there is going to be the holding of individuals' funds, we want a trust account, both so that we can make sure that there's no commingling, and two, so that if something happens to one of these companies and they themselves run into a legal problem or are subject to a judgment, that money can't be attached. And so we think that's an important protection. The crux of the matter, I believe, will come down to the issue of fees. And we've discussed fees to some extent in previous testimony, and I will tell you that we are trying to come up with the right, we've heard, right amount of fees. As I've said, the Dash Ones would propose a $50 one-time fee for opening a file, whether it's electronic or hard copy, just to get the process started. So that's a one-time fee. In addition, if education is provided, and this is already provided for in our current statutes, there is a $50 fee for recovery of costs associated with printing and educational materials. Then in addition, the current law allows for up to 15% of all monies paid into the trust accounts for the debt consolidation agencies, allows for them to take 15% of all monies paid to cover their expenses. So if you paid in $100 a month to be then paid on to the various creditors, 15% of that could be held by the debt consolidation agencies. And we aren't changing that, but what we are proposing to do is to say 15% or $65 a month, whichever is less. And I think you'll hear from, as I say, Jan Ameling, who will probably tell you that they probably rarely would get up to the $65 amount. But nonetheless, we just said it should be capped and not exceed that amount. And this is information we received from people that came in and testified on behalf of the for-profit debt consolidation agencies. They said $65 was something that they felt was reasonable. For those companies that don't hold money, the debt settlement companies, if you will, we think it's they should be held to the same standard, and that is that they should be allowed to take up to 15% or $65, whichever is less, of the amount of money that is put aside each month into the consumer's bank account to be collected and built up to be paid out eventually at the time that the negotiations are concluded. We realize that's a significant change from the current business model, and because of that, we are then proposing that there should be an incentive so that at the back end of the time of the debt negotiations, if they're successful, whatever dollar amount of principal that's been saved, for instance, if, and I'll give you an example, whatever dollar amount of principal that's been saved, 7.5% of whatever has been saved for the consumer should then be payable to the debt settlement company. So as an example, let's say a consumer has $50,000 worth of credit card debt. Not an unusual circumstance in these days, unfortunately. And let's say the debt settlement company is able to negotiate it at the appropriate time for $30,000. So there's a saving of $20,000. The provider would be able to charge 7.5% on the $20,000 saved, or an amount of $1,500 for having successfully negotiated a reduced amount and having paid, making sure that the consumers paid that amount and out from under that obligation. Just to draw to a close, the bill would also prohibit certain advertising practices. It would give us clear enforcement authorities to make sure that we can take people's licenses and suspend them or revoke them and impose monetary penalties if it's appropriate and we find violations of the law. It creates a private right of action, like we've discussed in other areas. As I've said, if we're talking about people that are setting aside $15,000 and $20,000 and something was to go awry, I think a private right of action is appropriate there. And then lastly, because so many of these companies are out of state and so many of these companies operate through the Internet, our agency's ability to impact these companies out of state is fairly limited. However, the Attorney General's office has a very effective way of reaching through and taking action against out-of-state companies through the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And so our proposal is to make violations of the Dash Ones also a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act under ORS 646.608. And therefore, the Department of Justice could actually go and pursue some of these people where we may be ignored if we try and seek some kind of enforcement. As I mentioned, there are some provisions within the bill that we think we can modify to clarify it better because of the time constraints that the House is under right now. We would appreciate the committee's approval of this bill as it's drafted, and then we will commit to work with stakeholders going forward to make sure we address those things that we can address. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and be happy to answer questions about the bill.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
How many companies do you expect to license or register? Do you have any idea at all?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, the state of Colorado recently passed a similar bill last year or so. When we checked with them, they had licensed four debt settlement type companies, four. And we have 55 already licensed as debt consolidation agencies, and we have 22 as credit service organizations. So we already have those 77 in place. We don't expect that to significantly change. We don't anticipate a lot of debt settlement companies coming in. So frankly, in our fiscal, we said it would be less than $50,000 in fiscal impact, less than a half FTE of a office specialist to what we typically call a secretary. And so we don't see that that will significantly change our regulatory oversight.
All right. Follow up, please.
I was looking at the fiscal. You and I talked about this bill. I think everybody wants to protect people that are already in trouble, that they're, you know, that if they're going to provide a service, that they don't get taken to the cleaners and be in a worse position than they were. But like all these fiscals and expenditure things I'm seeing come out from agencies, you're going to bring them, you said you're going to bring them into regulation, you're going to license and register, you talked about accounting, you're going to set bonds, you're going to register and license, and you're going to oversee contract content. You're going to be checking trust accounts if they have them, and you're going to do enforcement. And you're going to do that for $50,000 or less.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, the $50,000 would be in addition to what we currently do with our debt consolidation agency and credit service organizations. We already have surety bond activity. We already have contract license. We already have rulemaking in place. What we would do is pick up this additional area, the debt settlement area, and we anticipate, as I say, maybe Colorado, the four in Colorado was an anomaly, but we don't expect to see a whole host of people come in and getting licensed. In addition, our enforcement powers give us the authority to collect the cost of our enforcement efforts, so that would be separate and apart. We recover the cost of attorney time, whether it's AG attorney time or our investigator time. So with respect to your question around the regulatory piece, setting the enforcement piece aside, we think that it will be still within the ballpark of who we are currently licensing, and we don't see a significant change. And the enforcement piece, as I say, if there's a major enforcement problem, we'll do one of two things. We will, if possible, collect our own costs as part of any settlement of an enforcement action, or two, we'll turn it over to the Department of Justice. And I can't speak for them, but I've heard them testify that what their methodology is in pursuing Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
Follow up, please.
Then you're talking about maybe four. What were the total number of complaints that you got from the existing number that you talked about? You gave us some numbers there.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, as I said, we've gotten a number of complaints. Most of them are involving these debt settlement companies, of which we currently have taken a position we have no jurisdiction over, and we've referred them on to DOJ. Should we get these complaints, yes, we would probably have to take an initial look. And if there are violations, as I said, I think we have the ability to collect our enforcement costs as part of any enforcement action we take. If we didn't do anything more than that, then that would result in some time of staff. But typically, if we don't take a complaint beyond a review of the complaint and determine that there's no violation or nothing more that we need to do, that's an hour to an hour and a half of time.
Follow up again.
What I was really referring to is not you've got how many complaints are you getting? You said you got a number of complaints. Are you talking? You gave me some figures earlier, and I just kind of wondered, because if you got a given number out of a 100 other companies, and now you're going to add 4 more companies, that would mean you're talking about we're doing a whole thing here for four phantom companies.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, I believe I've confused you. We have 77 companies that do credit service organization work and debt consolidation work. What we are expecting is less than 10 companies that are debt settlement companies to decide to come in and do that additional work in Oregon. The rest, I suspect, will choose not to come in and get licensed. And if they choose not to get licensed and they don't work in Oregon, then we don't have a problem. Right now we have a number of complaints, and as I said, I would look at it as about 35 to 40 complaints we've received in the last 18 months about debt settlement practices. We've referred those on to the Department of Justice because, as I say, we don't have the current authority to do any type of enforcement. Should that change, then yes, they would become potential enforcement matters.
Thank you. I think we've got a bunch of other testimony to go. I appreciate you doing a pretty thorough job of explaining the Dash 1 amendments and the bill and the issues. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Let's see, which way do I go here? Next up we have Tammy Russell, Karen Lerner, and Diane Clover, or Donald Clover. Oh, come on up. How about Ronald Lockhart? Evening. I appreciate you coming up to give us your take on this bill and the issue. If you would identify yourself for the record before you start speaking.
My name is Karen Lehner, L-E-H-N-E-R.
Go ahead and begin.
I went through a horrible credit period a year and a half or so ago, and in the middle of paying my bills online, this email was there from this debt consolidation place. We can help you. And it happened to be in Boca Raton, Florida. I called them. We can help you. They never promised anything other than verbally. They told me, do not communicate with my creditors. Do not pay my bills. They charged me an upfront fee for a couple of months of around, it was about $187 for a couple of months. Then it dropped. I was to put money aside in my own bank account, which was not involved in with any of my creditors. Then, after a short period of time, they would negotiate with my creditors. When they came to a negotiation, kind of an agreement, they would let me know, see if I approved, then I would pay the creditor. That was the agreement. What happened was they took the money out of my bank account for their fee, and I have no problem with that, because they told me, and I agreed, all they were doing was what I could have done on my own if I had the nerve, which I didn't. My problem was that they did nothing at all. Every time I would call them, email them, write to them, in any way communicate with them, they kept saying, oh, do you want us to start negotiations? Of course I do. They took my money every month and never, ever did one thing. I finally wrote to DOJ in Florida, where they were. They said they had no authority. So I wrote to DOJ here, or DFCS, I'm not sure which I wrote to, since I work for DCBS, I can't remember. A lady at DOJ named Brenda Myers started negotiating with them and ended up getting me a full refund of all the money they had taken from me. They never did do one thing that I could show you in black and white to negotiate to deal with any of the creditors I had, which were only three. So that's my story.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Ron Lockhart, and basically I went through somewhat the same thing she just did, but mine was different. Basically, I went through a federal debt reduction company where I set on a payment each month, which came out of my bank account, and they were supposed to negotiate with the creditors and keep me updated and all that. And as you see, the letter I sent to them, dated February 23rd of 2009, basically states that they did not do a single thing for me except take $5,000 from me. My credit is still in the hole. They haven't done anything for me. So basically, I filed a complaint with the DOJ here, and I submitted a copy of my contract with the packet I gave you guys. And also, at the same time I filed the complaint with the Department of Justice here, I also filed a complaint with the Better Business Bureau out of California where this company is located. Well, they have, since I filed these complaints, refunded me the full amount of my contract. But in the meantime, one of the companies that was supposedly under this contract, I ended up going through a judgment and a garnishment, almost losing my house because this company did not do a single thing that they agreed to do. I contacted this company many times. They gave me a bunch of bogus garbage to file with the court system, which basically did nothing for the settlement of the garnishment or the judgment. So what I ended up having to do was borrow money from a friend to stop the judgment or stop the garnishment and end up settling with Beneficial for almost $10,000. And since then, I have also had to settle with another one of the companies that they supposedly took care of, which was Capital One, for $2,000 out of my pocket on top of. So basically, I was out almost $20,000, and I only had less than $15,000 in debt.
Mr. Chair, could I add one more thing to mine?
Certainly.
Because of the time period where I did not communicate with my creditors at their instruction, I did end up filing bankruptcy, and so I had the money saved to pay my lawyer to do that. So I'm better off.
The final straw that broke the camel's back, you might say, was at the very end, after I did make the 18-month commitment payment plan to them, they had the nerve to send me a affidavit saying that, oh, I was very happy with their service. Which, needless to say, I never signed or returned to them, which is the back section of your packet I gave you.
Well, thank you for sharing your experience with this issue, and I'm certain that you're not the only one. As my interim committee members know from last session, I had a constituent that went through a similar process, which alerted me to this issue to start with, and went through a similar situation where money was being taken out, and she couldn't afford it, ended up getting her wages garnished, and actually ended up in worse shape than she started.
So did I, but which I'm working on that.
Yeah, well, good for you. I'm glad you're still in there trying. appreciate your testimony tonight, and I'm going to move on with some more testimony. Thank you very much.
Next up, I have Lewis Finley.
This is my daughter, Ellen Finley. She helps me a little bit in the ear department.
Thank you. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Lewis M. Finley.
Thank you. You provided us written testimony, so I don't suspect that we need to have you read it to us. But if you just want to summarize real quick your testimony, that would be great.
Sure, I'd be glad to do that if I may. I'm the president of Family Financial Planners. We don't have any branches. We just operate on one in Portland, Oregon. We've never operated in any other area. To my knowledge, we've never had a complaint in 43 years. We've never had a complaint from the city, the county, the state, or any other agency. And we've helped thousands of families out of debt, and we taught many of them how to stay out. What makes us unique is that we represent the debtor. If you're being paid by the creditor, you certainly can't represent the interests of a debtor. We teach families how to save and control their finances until they're out of debt and they stay out. We know the way out of debt is not getting a loan. The way out of debt is to balance the budget at home. So you stop running short, making new debt. And so 9/10 of what we do is working with that person on payday, teaching them how to manage their money. And I could spend 2 hours going into it, but I certainly will abbreviate it. We are the only agency in this state. Let me say that again. We are the only agency in this state with a surety bond held by the state for $10,000. Everybody else has a fidelity bond. A fidelity bond pays off to the employer in the event the employee is found guilty, and it's hard to do if he just skipped town. Or found not guilty. Too bad. A fidelity bond is no bond at all, so nobody has any bonds except us. We feel that we can live with every part of this bill, and we have no objections to any of them. Except that where it says limiting the fee to $65 a month, if you do that, then you'll be working with dead counselors. A fee is contained within the payment received for creditors, and that payment's always adjusted to what the debtor can afford to pay. We said we don't do business by mail or clairvoyance. We're sitting right at that debtor's elbow on payday just about all the time as we start off. And what do you think we put first? It's food. We primarily serve the small debtor who is a private debt in a nominal way. Parts of this bill now say that the fee's going to be limited to $65, and nobody can afford to live on that. And it has to be a reasonable amount. We find that it says something about a maximum fee of $65, and it's placed the amount of $250 as the average client when he or she pays our trust account a sum of money. The funds are distributed to an average of 18 creditors. The cost of postage, check generation, and accounting averages $7.50 per check, or $135. So you see, if you put in a $65 maximum fee, we'd have a deficit of $70 a month. And in addition to the cost of $7.50 per check, we have rent, utilities, phone, insurance, bonding, all the other expenses. The advantage of having a counselor to work for the debtor means he can represent the debtor. He can put his living expenses first, keep the family afloat, teach them how to save, and at all times put the family budget first. We adjust the payment in times of emergency to what the debtor can afford, and as an end result, we repay the creditor all his money due. We know from a great deal of experience, this is the way to rebuild credit ratings and treat everyone fairly so that in the end, credit ratings are restored after all the word credit is a synonym for debt. It's not a credit rating, it's a debt rating. It's not a credit card, it's a debt card. Is that evil? Of course it's not evil. It's only evil by those who would misuse and do the other things that contribute to this problem. Now, I know you told me to limit it. I'm sorry I talked that long. I'll stop. Am I open to questions?
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony.
I'd like to say something when he's done.
This is my daughter. Yeah.
If you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Ellen Finley, and I just wanted to address the committee on a couple of things. My father's obviously reputable, very passionate about what he does and has been doing it for many years and has always given away way more time than he's charged for. That said, though, I believe that this bill really needs to clarify the fee structure. In reading the bill and talking with many people, I see that you've got $50 in there for counseling sessions, $50 initial fee, $65 if they are paying out to creditors, and some part of a bonus. No matter how ethical you are, trying to decipher exactly what that means, what you can charge per month, it's pretty much like trying to read Russian. I think that needs to really be cleared up if this bill is to pass and is to promote ethical, responsible credit counselors, as there are some in this state. I think we all have to agree that this bill is probably long overdue. There are so many charlatans taking advantage of people coming from all angles that something has to be done, and I applaud the committee for doing that. I think what I would like to have defined and what really needs to be defined is how much can an ethical credit counselor charge that will keep his doors open and, you know, promote ethical credit counseling.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony tonight, and thank you for coming forward. I really need to move on with the rest of the testimony. Thank you. Next up, I have Jan Amling.
My name is Jan Amling. I'm with Money Management International. Our agency was Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Lynn Benton, Incorporated until July 1st, 2008. We merged with MMI at that time so that we could offer expanded services to our families, such as housing counseling and services by phone and internet for those that were not able to come into our office during the 8 to 5 Monday through Friday setup that we experienced. We have worked with Representative Holvey and DCBS to try and craft a reasonable bill. The bill that you have could use a little bit of tweaking, but in general, our agency supports the bill as it's crafted and know that we can work with DCBS in the future to work with any small things that might need to be revised about it.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony.
I originally had written testimony, but it was for a different bill that, you know, you've since modified, so I there was no point in bringing that forward.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And you testified earlier on the original bill on the issue, and so and I appreciate your help in the work group that we had in offering your ideas and your insights and how the industry works. It was very helpful. And I'm not seeing any questions. So I do want to try to get through some other testimony yet, because there's some others with other points of view for sure. Let's go to Heather Carmichael and Bob Linderman.
Hello, Chairman Holby and committee again. Thank you very much for the chance to testify in front of you guys again. This has been such a work in progress, and I wholeheartedly agree with Ms. Amling's comments as well. There's a bit of a smokescreen in this bill.
If you could introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Heather Carmichael with USOBA. We're the United States Organizations for Bankruptcy Alternatives. So in the U.S., we have about 140 member companies. And along with TASC, the Association of Settlement Companies, we have begun to do so much self-regulation as an industry. Our latest estimates show that we collect or settle about $200 million a month collectively. And zero of those companies in our expanding industry will come and register her, not even four. The big difference to me that I want to make sure that you take away from this is that our industry is the only third-party advocate that consumers have from credit card companies. So unlike debt management companies, consumer credit counselors, we don't take any fair share funding from creditors. At the end of the day, they make more money than we do at the proposed 15% fee cap. The other point that I'd like to make quickly is that whether one card gets enrolled into the program or 10, if there's a $65 fee cap, the work is exponentially greater for 10 cards than one. So structurally, that fee structure doesn't make business sense, nor could any company do ethical business, which is the whole point. So there are a few technical changes, as Jan said, that I think we can all work out, and I certainly want to take the time to thank Ms. Cox and Chairman Holby and the DCBS for their time as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Linderman, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robert Linderman. I'm general counsel for Freedom Debt Relief, which is one of the largest and the fastest growing debt settlement companies in the country. I'm also a member of the legislative committee of TASC, which is the Association of Settlement Companies. TASC is the largest of the industry associations. We represent more than 175 participants, and I'm appearing before you today on behalf of TASC. I have some written testimony that I prepared, which Mr. Oxley will be distributing to your to Ms. Hoppe. I apologize. But rather than segue into that directly, I'd like to address myself to a few of the points that I've heard raised in testimony earlier. And I do want to point out, I want to thank the representatives of DCBS as well as Representative Holby. This has been a work in progress. It's been collaborative. It's been, I think, at times, there's been a great dynamic tension between ourselves, and it's been resolved in the creative process in a way that I feel is we are very, very close. I guess if I can be amusing for a moment, we're in violent agreement with much of what Mr. Tatman has said. What we do differ on is the fee issue, and that is a serious consideration for us. We've attempted to address it in Dash 2, the amendments before you. Unfortunately, Legislative Council, when preparing the amendments, did not pick up the changes that we requested, which is specifically the elimination of the $65 per month charge, as well as a 15% cap on fees. I'd like to talk a moment about that, because we hear a lot about your fees are too much. We hear that our fees are taken out before we provide any services, and that is sometimes true. We have a program that debtors are asked to follow, and that program involves sometimes a 36 to 48 month commitment, and we work continuously from day one with our participants. So in fact, services are being provided from the very moment that we initiate contact with our customers. By the way, I should also point out that if you take 15% of the committed debt and amortize that over a 3 to 4 year program when we're providing services, you get something like a 3 to 4% compounded rate annually of fees. When you measure that up against a 29% credit card rate, I suspect that you might conclude we're underpaid. I think also we're going to hear that we encourage consumers not to pay their debts. That is actually not the case at all. That would be giving them legal advice to break contracts, and that's something we absolutely cannot do. In fact, consumers who enter our program are usually on the verge of or have already stopped paying their debts. Unfortunately, that's simply a state of affairs that cannot be assisted. We do not find, by the way, when consumers enter our program that they are more prone to receive litigation from creditors who are aggrieved. In point of fact, because creditors know our organizations are reputable, and they know that we help consumers adhere to certain financial discipline, and they know that when we call them up and say, we'll settle your debt for this amount of money, that we have the means to back that up. They prefer liquidity to litigation. In fact, just as a statistic, my company settles more than 4,000 accounts per month. We settle more than $20 million of outstanding credit per month, less than 1% of our entire customer base experiences a litigation on any of those accounts. I guess one last point that I'd like to make, and then I'm glad to take your questions. I think by far the most common complaint that we hear from people is that we provide no value and provide no refunds to those who, for whatever reason, are unable to complete our program. As you heard Mr. Tatman say, 55% graduation rate in our program. We actually think that's something we can boast about because credit counseling has a graduation rate of less than 33%. Chapter 13's rates of completion are substantially lower, and in both cases, those programs go on for considerably longer. In point of fact, we do encourage people, if they have problems, to contact us, and in many, many cases, we do refund fees. We recognize that people have different reasons for dropping out of the program. Sometimes they have financial hardships, and we work with our clients, and we treat them as partners. I do acknowledge that the refund policies are more or less on a case-by-case basis. We are delighted and, in fact, have made the offer to DCBS to work with a refund policy that would show if a consumer, for example, made and accomplished a 12-month commitment to the program, we would be willing to refund a portion of his or her fees that were not associated with any settled debt. We believe there are solutions to these problems, and we would be delighted to work with DCBS and the committee in finding those solutions. And with that, if you have any questions for me, I'd be delighted to answer them.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you so much. Mr. Lindemann, I saw see one of the guarantee that you have, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, paragraph down, last line, that you would guarantee that the sum of fees paid in the settlements achieved would not exceed the original amount of the debt. So if I were looking to you for help, how would that be very compelling to me?
Representative Holby, Representative Tomei, perhaps I misstated or didn't have a chance to articulate that properly in the document. What I was saying was that there are hybrid methodologies we can use to help consumers understand, or maybe better said, to help the committee come to an understanding that we are willing to cap fees. This is not necessarily a program that we have initiated.
I'm just going to stop you there because yes, ma'am. I guess I'm not. If I were coming to you to help me out of a debt problem and I saw the guarantee on that line that I'm not going to owe you any more than I already know owe my debtors, why would I contract to work with you?
Representative Holby, Representative Tomei, I guess what I'm saying is there are going to be certain circumstances where creditors are unwilling. But if I guarantee you that you're never going to be worse off, and in fact you will be better off by working with, I'm not going to guarantee you that you'll be better off. I will tell you, however, that statistically our company settles debts at an average of 10 to 40, our average settlement is now 47 cents on the dollar. So if you add 15% on top of that, you get to 62%. So if I tell you that statistically you're likely to experience a 38% reduction in the amount of your debt, I think that's a pretty fair deal.
Thank you. And may I ask a question of Ms. Carmichael? He's busy. I'm going to ask the question. Ms. Carmichael, what seat do you know that you're in?
Oregon.
Right. And the second page. Pardon?
Did I make a typo? I'm so sorry.
You did. You said Tennessee.
Oh, yeah, I was there.
So you must be doing a similar kind of issue in Tennessee, is that correct?
Yeah, and I'd like to clarify, we're working on legislation in 14 states. So, and Colorado is very different in this bill, and we wholeheartedly support the legislation there. So we've been actively working with NACUSL for about 3 years now, and Tennessee is one of those states, and 14 others in total that we're running legislation in.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seeing any at this time, and I know that the fee structure is something that you addressed that didn't get drafted correctly in your dash 2 amendment, and you know, I'd asked this question once before, and I'm you know, and looking at this model, I'm wondering to myself, I guess, when people are putting so much money away, you know, what service is it that you actually provide consumers on a monthly basis? I mean, after you set up the account, what do you actually do? I mean, we heard testimony that, you know, nothing was done, you know, nothing. People that were here, and I believe one person actually had an issue with the DOJ with the company you represent. And so and he was testifying too that he ended up in worse shape than when he started in his debt. And so, what was he paying for on a monthly basis?
That's an excellent question. When you sign up, and by the way, it's a personal embarrassment when we hear people that have poor results with Freedom Debt. 55% of our people graduate with excellent results. There are some that don't. We have 61,000 clients, and if I could satisfy each and every one of them, I would. So I guess with that as a background, when a person signs up with Freedom Debt, and by the way, that person does not just go to the website, fill out a form, and presto, he's a client. We have a financial analysis program that we run. We reject probably 8 to 9 out of 10 applicants because, as we heard earlier tonight, there are people that this program can't help. There are people that taking money from them would be wrong. There are people who are too close to bankruptcy and too close to financial ruin for us to help. Our program requires a certain amount of financial discipline, very similar in many ways to what the credit counselors require, although our program generally requires deposits of about half what the credit counselors require. We work with our clients, and to itemize the services is difficult because we have probably 250 customer service representatives and evenly distributed between Sacramento and Phoenix who answer calls on a daily basis from every single one of our clients. I would say each one of our clients contacts one or more of our counselors probably once to twice a week. When you multiply that over 61,000 people, that's quite a few people that we help. So there's considerable amount of hand-holding because, as you can imagine, when you stop paying your debts, there's no guarantee that we make that we can stop creditors from calling. What we can do and what we do is get from the clients at the time the program begins a consent to contact the creditors. We send that consent form to the creditors and ask that the creditors direct their communications to us. Sometimes they agree and sometimes they don't. When you can imagine that when the creditors do agree, and as I pointed out earlier, because of our gravitas within the industry, creditors are interested in working with us because they know our commitments are good. So we actually field considerable number of calls on a daily basis from creditors. We make a lot of outbound calls to creditors. We work closely with our clients to make sure that they're not being overwhelmed by their burdens. And we make every effort to assist them in the process by educating them, by helping them get access to their accounts, by explaining to them how each time there's a debit to their accounts, why that debit occurs and where the money goes. We believe in full transparency.
thank you for that. I recognize that your company provides a value at when you actually settle the debt and are able to reduce the debt that's owed, and that a piece of the legislation or proposed in this proposed amendment is something that I thought was, you know, tailored to your business model a little bit. Simply that when you actually provide the value to somebody, then you get paid for it. But I do struggle a little bit with the necessity of a higher monthly fee. Just, you know, from my looking at the issue.
Rep. Holby, pardon me, may I speak to that?
Certainly.
I think if you did a survey of, certainly of task members, and as I said, we represent 175 of the leading debt settlement companies in the country, that you'd find that a very small and declining fraction of them work on a back-end model. And part of the reason is that our companies are structured in such a way that the actual work of customer service, of creditor negotiation, and of actually managing the process is a front-loaded process.
Right, and I appreciate that, but in you know, just, you know, from my perspective, when I have talked to constituents in my district that have run into problems with this business model, it is exactly that they have money taken out of their accounts and for fees along the way, and they end up in worse financial shape and not getting their debt settled. And so it seems to me that the value that you provide the customer, as we heard from testimony, is not being provided on the monthly fee basis, but at the tail end, where you actually negotiate the debt and save them some money and get their credit paid for. And that's, you know, I think somewhat reflective of the approach that we've taken on these fees specifically, and how the structure of that works. And I know it's not exactly what your companies do, but it's very difficult to struggle with these cases where I've come to understand, you know, how people are being harmed, and they oftentimes get their wages garnished. And I believe Ms. Carmichael, I believe you, lastly, when you were here, you worked for Credit Solutions, and the constituent that I had, you know, when I asked you some questions about that, was harmed in almost exactly the same way through Credit Solutions taking money out of the account and ended up taking a tremendous amount of fees from a constituent of mine that was a single mother making $10 an hour, and they were taking $221 a month out of her account. And essentially she had nothing left in her account. She was broke. She ended up getting her wages garnished in the meantime, and it was not a very successful model. And so from my standpoint, if a debt settlement company is going to be successful in this industry, they need to provide the value to the consumer by actually settling their debt and providing the services that they advertise they would deliver. And so from my perspective, I guess that's kind of how I see the situation, and I appreciate that you deal with thousands of people, but you know, and we hear about the problems. You know, we don't maybe necessarily hear about the successes, and certainly you've elaborated on some of your successes, but I guess the problems are what bother me. And how do we protect those consumers in that situation? Because I can guarantee you that my constituent's life is very, very drastic right now, that she would have been much better off had she never entered into a debt settlement agreement with the company you work for. And so when I listen to all this and try to keep an open mind, it bothers me, because people that come in contact that we've had testimony on have not had good experiences. And so you know, how do we structure the industry that it currently has no regulation on it at all? How do we do that to help protect consumers? And that's our challenge. And it's certainly not my intent to lecture you on this. You know your industry better than I do, I'm sure. But my position here is looking out for consumers, and so that is what I'm troubled by. And that's why we kind of set this fee structure up the way we did, was to prevent consumers who get into this situation from just, quite frankly, being taken advantage of when they shouldn't have probably been in this arrangement to start with. And, you know, if you do deliver a value, you should be paid for it. And so I think that fee structure allows that to happen. If you do provide that value of settling the debt and reducing their debt by 40% or whatever, you get a percentage of that. So that's the proposal that we have right now. And certainly I'm sorry that your Dash 2 amendment didn't come back the way you wanted, so we can speak to that real briefly. But essentially, if I'm correct, your amendment just simply was supposed to take away the $65 cap, per month cap, and just allow the 15% on a monthly fee. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That is correct, although okay. I must say it wasn't articulated the way that we would have preferred. Again, as I said to you, and we've talked about this many times, we don't believe that 15% should be taken out in a one lump sum. It couldn't possibly. That would leave the consumer penniless. What we believe is that fee should be spread out over the half-life of the program. Mm-hmm. And in response to your concerns, which, to be candid with you, these are honest and legitimate concerns, we would be very open to working with you to design a refund policy that addresses some of those concerns. What we don't feel is appropriate is to put an economic collar around the industry that would result in, as Mr. Tatman pointed out, less than four companies coming in. It would effectively deny the citizens of Oregon the opportunity to take advantage of those of us who practice this in an ethical and responsible manner.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. Questions? Representative Riley.
Yeah, just the last thing you said spurred a question, because I heard that you like Colorado's law, but they only have four coming in, and you think that's a problem.
Do you mind if I respond? Representative Holby, Representative Riley, part of the reason that the Colorado law has only four registrants, and by the way, credits... Oh, seven now? Yeah. Credit Solutions and ourselves both are registered under Colorado law, is because they have a requirement of 2 years of audited financial statements. Many of the practitioners in this business simply don't have audited financial statements for one reason or another. Now, we're not opposed to that. As you see before you, you've got the two largest players in the industry sitting here, and both of us have audited financial statements, so that to us is not an issue. But audited financial statements, at least for many smaller companies that are not public, very rarely have financial statements prepared according to generally accepted accounting principles.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any other comments at the moment, but I will also mention the article I found from the New York Times. And of course, lawsuits don't necessarily mean anything, but it does give me pause when I see Credit Solutions is being sued by the state of Texas right now for engaging in false and deceptive and misleading acts and practices. That does give me pause as well. So
can I respond? I really want Reed to send me information on that constituent, too. I'm glad you only have 35 to 40 complaints here. Home Depot alone last year got over 6,000, and they sell nails. So unfortunately, no company, no industry is perfect. I cannot comment, obviously, on pending litigation, nor am I a lawyer. But I can tell you that although we founded the company, we sold it in 2006. And then we bought the company back, as hopefully the op-ed piece will appear in the New York Times later on next week. So we are cleaning up a lot of messes. We take full responsibility for them and have been engaged in working on a quick resolution with Greg Abbott's office. And so I hope that helps a little bit. And if Ree okay. will send me that person's info, we'd like to help her as well. And we do have a very strong refund policy in place. and 61 different ways when you get an offer in from your creditor that we can help you find ways to get that money. So it's like saying everybody in prison is bad, all credit card companies are good. Things don't tend to work in those extremes. It's very much a two-way street for someone to be successful in this program. You have to keep saving money, and you have to do your work, too. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. I have just a few more people to testify, committee, and then we won't be moving this bill tonight or adopting any amendments. I feel we need to have a little more time on this. So I do have Keith Carnes and Sybil Hebb.
Mr. Chair, just a question. Do we have a fiscal on either of the amendments at this point, or will we? Okay. I'll dig for it then. It's probably in here somewhere.
Well, it may not be because we just got it. Representative Cowan and...
I was just curious.
Thank you. Who else do I have left? Angela Martin, too.
We just got them in for fiscal.
You represented the May and all of the years.
No. Yeah. These guys don't
Thank you. Introduce yourself for the record, please, whoever would like to proceed.
Thank you, Representative Holtby and members of the committee. My name is Keith Carnes. Previously, I had given written testimony on this, and I'll incorporate a little bit of that in my remarks. One of the documents that I provided previously in my written testimony was a document provided by Freedom Financial that advised their clients not to speak to Citibank or NBNA when they called seeking to collect on a bill. Obviously, MBNA was merged into Bank of America or FIA Card Services, and so that document was a couple years old, but that's something that Freedom Financially actually has done in the past. One of the things that concerns me generally, in my experience with this industry, comes from my clientele. I do consultations free of charge to poor folks in Oregon who need to talk about bankruptcy or debt collection or credit reporting or other financial problems they have. And many, many clients of mine came to me and told similar stories to what the citizens had told about paying as many as $7,500 in upfront fees or $5,000 in upfront fees and receiving nothing in exchange except for lawsuits and garnishments. The Federal Trade Commission, Mr. Roche, spoke to the debt settlement industry, and the debt settlement industry hosted him. And in his speech, he advised that perhaps that self-regulation is the best way to go. But his concern was that they wouldn't even give him a list of their membership or what their industry standards were proposed to be. They don't seem to be willing to come out. They say they have industry standards, and they have refund standards, and they have membership requirements, things like that. Unfortunately, they're completely unwilling to give that to anybody for any reason, it seems. Maybe the litigation in Texas will help fix that problem. Specific to Oregon, there's one specific to Oregon, we have a somewhat aggressive collection bar in the State Bar of Attorneys. Anyone who writes a letter and demands payment of $5,500 or less can collect all their attorney fees and costs if they're successful in litigation. And so we have several law firms who do nothing but send out $5,500 letters on credit cards and the like. 11 days later, they'll file suit. 30 days later, obtain a default judgment and begin garnishing. A lot of my clients who are in these debt settlement services will contact the company and say, what do you want me to do? And they'll have them fax the complaint and do all sorts of things, and they'll try and settle these up as quick as they can. Unfortunately, oftentimes that doesn't work, and my clients end up with default judgments against them. As far as the fees go, for a Chapter 13, for a very complicated, you know, for instance, it's a matter of public record, I'll share it. We filed Chapter 13 for Bailey Seed, who's a big seed supplier in the valley here. We didn't charge them $7,500. I mean, that would seem unconscionable. And we had our most experienced senior attorneys working on that case for 5 years. And to charge somebody like that $7,500 would just seem excessive to me. Attorneys, you know, working at $300 an hour, billing in 6-minute increments on a typical Chapter 13 will usually charge around $2,500 or $3,500. To say that folks who are, you know, while I recognize that, you know, they're providing a service, I think we need to start breaking down what's the value of the service. How much per hour should they really be charging for the services that they're doing? $7,500 is just an astronomical amount of money, especially to those who are poor and already in difficult financial situations. One of the concerns that I'll voice lastly is the concern that keeps being brought about the failure of Chapter 13 bankruptcy. It's generally recognized that Chapter 13s don't have a high completion rate, and there's a reason for that. It's because most of them get converted to Chapter 7s and get discharged. The Chapter 13 is designed to save a house or to save a vehicle. And once those payments are caught up, there's no reason to be in Chapter 13 anymore. And so a lot of these cases, they get the arrears cured on the home or something like that. They get converted to a Chapter 7, and they're relieved of their debts, and they go on making their ongoing home and car payments. And so for the reasons I explained here, I know I've made a lot of points, and I hope I was clear. I'm happy to answer any questions you have, but for the reasons stated, I would hope that you would pass the bill as it's drafted in the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center in support of House Bill 2191 with the Dash 1 amendments. I really want to thank the committee for your continuing attention to this issue and the leadership of the chair in bringing this conversation forward, as well as DCBS. From the Law Center's perspective, as you know, we provide services to low-income people across the state. Part of our mission is trying to help people break the cycle of poverty. And unfortunately, these debt management companies that are the subject of this legislation serve to further trap people in the cycle of poverty. And an experience that I'd like to share about a client that I know of in one of our Eastern Oregon offices was brought to my attention. It is similar to many stories that have come to our attention from many clients across the state. We're seeing an increasing number of questions and concerns related to this practice. And this is an elderly woman who was in her late 70s living in Eastern Oregon. She was getting by on her Social Security income as well as some help from family members in the area. As we all know, the increasing unemployment rate is going through the roof, and her family members became less and less able to help her as they were struggling to keep food on the table for their own families as their job hours were getting reduced. She was able to go back to work and got a job at Walmart part-time, increasing her hours over the months because they were becoming more, you know, she needed the money more. She was eventually working almost 40 hours a week and trying to pay off some consumer debt that she had, being responsible, had come up with a plan. I mean, she was making a plan, trying to pay as she could go. It got beyond her. She couldn't make the payments anymore. She had a lot of stress about this and was just really worried about what the impact would be on her family if she was not able to pay her debts, and that was a significant concern for her. She sought the services of a debt management company that was advertising, come to us, we'll help you, we'll give you counseling, we'll put you on a payment plan, we'll take regular payments from your bank account. She was on an automatic withdrawal, making payments to them on a monthly basis, was advised not to contact the companies, not to have any connection with them, and to let the debt management company handle that relationship, and didn't find out until months later when she was served with two lawsuits by two of her creditors that the service that she had been paying for had not given assent to her creditors. And so she was and just devastated by the fact that not only had her credit ratings gone even further down the drain, but she was facing two lawsuits and increased expenses as a result, having also just paid out a significant amount of money through to the company. So I just I echo the experience on behalf of our clients that have been shared and really appreciate the effort to provide some reasonable and appropriate regulation in this industry. So thank you.
Thank you. Before you go on, do you know if the company that she was working with contacted her her creditors?
They had not contacted the creditors, so they had not made any payments or made any arrangements, and so it was just a complete stoppage of the relationship.
In my constituent's case, that was the same, that months later there had been no contact. And
she had been ignoring calls. The creditors had been trying to call her, as they would have done, and she had been advised by this company that she was paying money to not to take, you know, not to contact, and so it's unfortunately... Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Cowan.
Quick question of Sybil.
Certainly.
Just in follow-up on that particular issue, with your office's assistance, was there any attempt to contact the company that she was working with, and did she receive any credit back from the, or any compensation back from the company?
And Chair Holvey and Representative Cowan, and I apologize for not recognizing you earlier when I responded. We're in the process of working with her right now, so we've made outreach, but the case has not been resolved.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to try to pick apart a particular case, but we've heard some testimony about refunds when things don't go well, and so I was just curious. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Angela Martin with Owl, Oregon. I echo the comments that have been made here in support of House Bill 2191-1 amendment, and felt that while I don't have much to add substantively in my testimony, it was important enough for me to stay with you to this late hour to express our strong support for this bill. This business model of debt settlement companies has been so successful because they've done one thing really well. They've identified a problem. Consumers are backed into a corner. You make one late payment to your credit card company, even if it's an hour late, and you are faced with penalty payments that you will never escape. 30% interest is inescapable for consumers with that large amount of debt. But correctly identifying a problem that consumers are facing and matching that with a solution that's digging them further in is no solution at all. I appreciate all the work that's been done on this. Again, we support the Dash 1 amendments to 2191 and urge your support for those. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. I'm not seeing any further questions, and I have exhausted the panel of testifiers again tonight, so, and probably my committee. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2191. And committee, I need to carry over a few bills. And as soon as I get that list in front of me... So I would like to carry over House Bill 2191, House Bill 3163, House Bill 2189, House Bill 2199, House Bill 3145, House Bill 3004, House Bill 2370, House Bill 2784, and House Bill 2141. And with that, committee, we'll be taking up tomorrow probably House Bill 2189, 2199, 3004, and perhaps follow up on this bill. And anything else I have paperwork on.
Okay. Give us those numbers again.
Which ones?
The first numbers. I don't want to bring this big stack of bills again if you're not going to be hearing them.
House Bill 2189, House Bill 2191, House Bill 2199, House Bill 3004. You might bring House Bill 2370 and House Bill 2191.
Thank you.
Just the big fat file.
Didn't save a lot. Didn't save a lot. You saved a couple. And with that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.